This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome back to the second episode of the Dark to Light podcast with your hosts, Tracy Beans and
Frank.
You have to draw it out a little bit to make
it. Frankie Val on the drums. What's going on, Tracy?
Dun, dun.
Yeah, it's only episode two. Can you imagine when episode 100 going to be like? We're still pretty wet behind the ears right now, but we're going to get fine-tuned. You know that.
I know. And it's going to be great. Actually, it was really cool to read the reviews on the first show. And thanks everybody who went to Apple iTunes and did a review for us. It helps a lot. People liked it. People liked our little banter back and forth. And I think today we're going to get a little more on the analytical side. But it was a fun show. You agree?
Absolutely. And yes, big thank you to everybody who reviewed it, because that is a big time currency on the internet, especially when it comes to visibility on any of those the podcast charts and whatnot. Any kind of interaction with the content is huge. So the reviews, the stars, the subscriptions. I mean, that's all really great stuff. And thank you all so much for it. I had a great time, and I'm really, really excited for the future.
Yeah, me too. Everyone was asking us to do more than once a week. People are like, do more than one.
You have to understand, if you did anything more, and that's why I said, Tracy, listen, I know this is going to be a great thing, but if you wanted to keep up doing the thing that made your channel what it is, you can't do more than once a week, because you have to be doing work, putting together your own analysis on the channel and whatnot. This would work so much better, and people would get far less sick of us too.
This is true.
If you only did once a week, that's the risk I actually run on myself. I'm live every night for 2 hours now. I don't even want to be around myself that long.
Well, I think the audience likes you. I think you're doing pretty good.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason for everything. So today, we obviously, you know, we try to put a little outline of the show together, what we want to talk about. And the news this week has just been absolutely insane. But we want to start off with like the topic of the day today. And I know as we're doing this show, as we're recording this show, we're going to see some breaking news come across the screen because it's Friday and that's what happens on Fridays. But we want to talk about this Kimberly Strassel article about the FBI hiding a mole inside the Trump campaign. And Frank's going to help us out with that to start off, because you guys can't read it because this is a podcast.
Yeah. Now, what, you want me to read the whole thing?
I would just, you know, pick out the good bits about the end where she thinks she knows who it is.
Oh, yes. Well, there's a few things here. I mean, Strassel, the conclusion here at the end, this is the quote. I believe I know the name of the informant, but my intelligence sources did not provide it to me and refused to confirm it. It would therefore be irresponsible to publish it. But, you know, going on down, I think that the crazy thing was the second to last paragraph here, where it says, we also know that among the Justice Department's stated reasons for not complying with the Nunez subpoena was its worry that to do so might damage international relationships. This suggests that the source may be overseas, have ties to foreign intelligence, or both. That's notable given the highly suspicious role that foreigners have played in this escapade. It was an Australian diplomat who reported the Papadopoulos conversation. And also, I just want to interject there too, Tracy. She's talking about Alexander Downer and Papadopoulos. But before Papadopoulos exchanged cocktails with Alexander Downer, he was also hanging out with one Joseph Mifsud, who in his own right has had many potential ties to British intelligence drawn up in just the last couple of months alone, too. So as far as foreign involvement and relations goes, this is a pretty amazing point that she's making. But let me just finish up this paragraph. Dossier author Christopher Steele is British and used to work for MI6 and retains ties to that spy agency as well as to a network of former spooks. It was a former British diplomat who tipped off Senator John McCain to the dossier. how this top secret source fits into this puzzle could matter deeply.
Everything she just talked about matters deeply. Mm-hmm. Literally. I mean, it's all together. Now, if you guys have been following along, and I know we have a new sort of group of people that are listening that don't really know all this stuff. So to come into it like this is really complicated and it's really hard to follow, but I'm going to do my best. You know, all of these people that she just mentioned in this article, outside of even naming the source, have a story with how they played a role in what is absolutely the biggest conspiracy against the United States government in the history of the country, perpetrated by a lot of people within the United States government. I mean, there's no denying it at this point in time. We know it's undeniable. You can't. I mean, I don't know how people defend what's going on here. It's indefensible. Even if, let's pretend there was some reason why the FBI needed to look at the Trump team. They never told Trump about it. They never talked to him about it. They never gave him an intelligence briefing. They never gave him a heads up saying, hey, guys, there are people within your campaign that are, you know, doing some shady stuff. What did they do? They infiltrated the campaign instead? No, it just doesn't make sense if you're honest with yourself. Do you have any thoughts on that, Frank? Because that's basically...
You put it into a great nutshell. The only thing I would add to it as far as the enormity of the situation or the potential of the situation that we're looking at, it's not as if throughout human history you have this precedent that has just been established of people in power who either want to grab power or retain power to, dare I say, collude with each other. But I think that what we're seeing right now, especially in this phase of the game of our history, is that not only do we see a major, not even one scandal, but an interwoven web of scandals. On top of it is this whole digital sphere. I mean, it's not just cloak and dagger, back alley, you know, exchanges of information and campaign of whispers type of stuff. You just have, I mean, you're talking about the implanting of digital fingerprints, trying to frame foreign bodies through, you know, digital means and planting evidence and this and that. I mean, when you're talking about just the internet and the information age aspect layered on top of all of the old school human proclivities we have within government and corruption and power grabs, it makes this like, I mean, Tom Clancy is just holy damn, you know?
It's so crazy. I want to take Papadopoulos out of here. Now, I'm not saying Papadopoulos is the FBI mole that they're talking about here in this particular situation. But I do want to talk about Papadopoulos a little bit in regards to what his role was within the campaign and how he, you know, one of the things that has been an overreaching theme in this is that everybody that talked to the campaign, we have several people with intelligence community connections. We have several people that worked as sources for the U.S. government, that worked for the intelligence community as basically paid sort of informants for them, contracting outside the, you know, department. And we have a trend of overt communication with the campaign officials in question that you'd never communicate with people like this if you were actually really trying to hide something. Does that make sense what I'm saying there?
Well, absolutely. I think the most damning bits of evidence for anybody who's observing this on the outside with no real access to inside source information is just how openly and outwardly people like Papadopoulos were conducting themselves as if trying to say, hey, 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 look at me.
Yeah, look at me. I'm trying to set up meetings with Russians. I mean, Felix, it's I can't. Felix Sater. Felix Sater is another one. I know we're kind of jumping around here, but this is important. Felix Sater is a former high-level intelligence asset for the United States government who, he was involved with, like, getting nuclear weapons back that had been stolen. I mean, the guy was high-level. He's mentioned in Loretta Lynch's response to the testimony or to the questions that she needs to respond to for her confirmation hearing. Loretta Lynch worked with Sater in New York. Sater was a criminal by all intents and purposes, got into a lot of trouble, money trouble. The government kind of just said, okay, you're good to go. Don't worry about it. Wink and a nod. Do this for us. And he was supposed to, under the law, pay restitution to the people he had stolen from. But they wiped that. He didn't have to pay any restitution because he was going to cooperate with the government. And this is years and years and years ago. So all of a sudden now, this guy, Felix Sater, who was a high-level and very valuable intelligence asset for the apparatus inside the country, decides, and who's also just happens to be very close friends with Michael Cohen, not the fake Michael Cohen's, the real one.
How many are there?
There's a gazillion now.
It's like being Michael Cohen, you know? It's like, take John Malkovich out of there. Who wants to be Michael Cohen this week?
We had that on tap to talk about today. I think we'll get to it maybe at the end, but God, Michael Cohen, the real Michael Cohen he's friends with. Felix Sater, responsible for bringing the 2015 Trump-Russia, Trump Tower Russia letter of intent to the table. Felix Sater emails Michael Cohen and says, our boy is going to be president and I'm going to get Putin to buy in and help. You know, I've set up a meeting so Ivanka can sit in Putin's private chair. This is what he's emailing Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
During the campaign.
Yeah, that's like something that Pink Panther would do.
Yes.
You know, it really is just a caricature of all of the fumbling, bumbling intelligence types that you've ever seen in any kind of a sitcom or a parody. Like it's like a Leslie Nielsen or something like that. They got
so sloppy because what happened is, I firmly believe anyway that they realized that they were in deep trouble and they had to cover up their tracks. They had to cover what they were doing. If they, you know, the insurance policy, all the text messages, everything that everyone's talking about, they had to cover their butts and they really rushed it through. They didn't do a good job and he won. Despite all of this craziness, he still won. Think about that. He had literally intelligence assets implanted who wanted to take him out figuratively. And he still won the election. And I'm starting to wonder how far back he knew this was going on. Because if you remember, he started screaming that the election was rigged pretty early. We all thought he meant voter fraud. Maybe he didn't.
If you're going to be super fair about that, when you talk about the rigged statements, it does seem like it could be a number of things now. I mean, it actually accentuates just how miraculous the end result of the 2016 election was, because it wasn't even just that he might have started sniffing out rats and moles within his own, circles, but of course, you know, we're starting to get leaks in 2016 about what's going on at the DNC. We know how the DNC works with superdelegates and how much stock the Clintons had going on in there. We knew exactly who was lining all the walls at the agencies at that point. I mean, there is a lot of, and as far as voter fraud goes, that's without question at this point. I mean, Pennsylvania wasn't even that big of a play. He won Pennsylvania, but still 100,000 illegal voters were discovered not too long ago over there. And we know that with anybody out there that screams about the popular vote, most of the 2 million of the popular vote, that had to come from just New York and Los Angeles alone. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at the states that he won that had people voting illegally, can you imagine what the cobalt blue states like New York and California were doing? So as far as screaming about and saying that things are rigged, oh man, you can play that card from a number of angles.
I thought it was really interesting because I read through the entire House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence report that they put out about Trump Russia. And, you know, you could read it and see the partisanship left and right. It was, you know, there was a lot of good information in there, like about Papadopoulos, which we'll get to in a second. I just want to go over him a little bit. But What was interesting to me was that they, you know, they talked about the rigging of the election, the Russian interference into the election, and they run with this story that the Russians hacked the DNC, that the Russians gave the information to WikiLeaks. We can do that episode another day, but we all know what really happened there. Or at least we think we do. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's kind of irresponsible to even assume that we really know what's going on, given the magnitude of this. But from open source reporting and open source investigation, we can get a good idea. But so two things. Supposedly, Loretta Lynch and Sally Yates or Susan Rice testified that to the House Permanent Select Committee that Barack Obama, given that they had this really firm idea of what was going on inside of the government in terms of collusion and not collusion, in terms of hacking the elections and, you know, the Homeland Security, Jed Johnson came out and wanted to federalize and make it critical infrastructure and all that mess. They say that Obama actually met with Putin and discussed Russian meddling in the 2016 election at the end of bilateral discussions during the G20 summit in China in early September 2016 at a pull aside. So I want to get this straight, and I said this in my video. You mean to tell me that given what this report says that the government already knew about what Russians were supposedly trying to do to hack our election, Obama thought it so serious that he spoke to Putin for 2 minutes at a pull aside? He has the opportunity to talk to the man who's supposedly interfering in the United States of America's, you know, election for president, one of the things that we as citizens hold most sacred. And he takes 2 minutes to talk to him at a pull aside.
Also, this is the same man, Barack Obama, who gave assurances that there is no way that our electoral system could really be influenced in any kind of a way, and that there is no rigging going on, and Donald Trump should stop whining and go out there and get and persuade people to vote for him. So, you know, in the lead up to the election, when it seemed like everything was in hand, because there seemed to be so many, in retrospect, there seemed to be so many fail safes in place for Hillary Clinton to secure this victory. The real line of thinking was stop complaining. There's no rigging. There's no way that our electoral system could be compromised in such a way. And just go out there and run a good campaign and stop being a crybaby. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then like you just said, this is of such importance that it's a 2 minute pull aside. And then, of course, after the election goes in the way that they weren't expecting it, then we have to talk about international conspiracy.
Yeah. In the opposite way than it actually, it's projection, like always happens. And the interesting thing about what you just said, too, is, you know, I was hoping that you were going to say, because I'm sure you remember this, when he was on stage before he was reelected and he was like, I'll have more flexibility once I'm reelected. That's the kind of pull aside we're talking about, in my opinion. I don't see any other thing.
And that was in response. That was in response to the placement of American missile defense systems, mm-hmm. too. So mm-hmm. You want to talk about issues of consequence. You want to talk about issues of national security, whether or not you think that we should be putting missile defense systems all over the world and embassies and U.S. troops stationed all over the world or not. It doesn't matter. I mean, that is a really big thing to say, hey, just give me a couple of months with. And then, of course, you want to talk about reversing the impeachment, and you want to talk about picking apart the president's cabinet by going after Michael Flynn during a transition period after the election already was won, to go and reach out to a Russian ambassador or a diplomat of some type and say, hey, listen, there's a new sheriff in town. Please just don't do anything rash with this latest executive order. And we'll talk about it once we get into the White House. That was made into some sort of a treasonous act. But as far as a sitting president making assurances for something he will do for Russia after he may be reelected, that is something that should just be forgotten about. That was nothing.
Yeah, you're spurring me to a bunch of different points from what you're saying. You know, and not only like with Flynn, for example, God bless that man. It's coming to light now that forget unmasking Flynn. There may have been a FISA warrant on General Flynn. And so the fact that that's the case, and the State Department of the Obama administration came out when that was happening and said, we don't have any problem with it. It's no big deal. And they go scream the Logan Act. And in this House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence report, they get conflicting testimony from three different people about what exactly it is that General Flynn actually did wrong. Three people give three different stories. So it's an interest. I'd have to pull it up to find it, but it's interesting. The one other thing I wanted to get to quickly before we move on a little bit is the wording that was used here in this election rigging deal. What they say at the end is, in considering a public response, the executive branch was in a unique position. It was dealing with extremely sensitive intelligence and had to consider the impacts of jeopardizing sources and methods when declassifying intelligence. Furthermore, in the midst of an ongoing campaign, this is during the election now, it had to carefully consider any public statements or actions, as it did not want to be perceived as taking sides and politicizing the election. Or, and they put this in here specifically, according to former Secretary Johnson, fueling claims that the election was, quote, rigged. They use his exact words to say why they didn't address it. They didn't want to make it look like he was right. But he was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all about deflection. It's all about don't give anybody their due. It goes beyond that. It's just a game plan of everything. I mean, look, you have North Korean prisoners being let off of a plane, and what are they talking about? They're talking about a crisis that's being brought on with Iran because backing out of another deal. You cannot give credit where credit's due, shift to something else, and then months down the line, in a weird way, admit that people were right by making the same argument.
What really stinks is I don't want to have to wait until the history books are typed or written for people to realize what an amazing job this president is doing for this country. It's really sad that the entire power structure has been weaponized against this administration because they are doing exactly the opposite of what the global power structure would want them to do, right? And they're still succeeding somehow. There's a weaponized media. There is a weaponized intelligence community. There's a weaponized Five Eyes global intelligence community. There are countries that wanted to continue to move this idea of globalism forward that are weaponized against the president. And then there are those who are waking up and saying, hold on a second, this guy actually is making the world a better place for everybody. Saudi Arabia, Korea, Japan, even China. And I'm not a big foreign policy person, so I don't really get into that stuff. But it's very clear that there's a global shift happening right now. It's an amazing time to be alive. I love your input on that bit.
I don't want to make you I don't want to make dark to light too kooky, but I believe that I believe that there's something even far more extraterrestrial going on with this global shift. Like, I believe that there is how impressed you are with the progress that's being made in the face of extreme opposition. And I would have to, if I'm going to get a little bit less kooky about it, I'm just going to bring up some Victor Hugo and say, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And I believe that at this point, it doesn't matter how much kicking and flailing the old world power structure does to maintain what they used to have and what they were strangling the world off with. But I really do believe that we're coming upon a time, a global reset, if you will, that people just have to start accepting that the old ways of doing things are over, and that the collectivized view of the world is just something that is unsustainable, and people are waking up to it, and that there is a way to be liberal. There's a way to be classically liberal, socially liberal, but also reasonable and grounded in common sense without it being a political fiasco. And I think that those walls are falling away. And I'll get into all of the interdimensional reasons behind that on my own show, so I don't muddy your waters. But I'm totally on board with it. There is something happening right now that I believe is just there's a lot of there's a lot of karmic push behind it. That's why I think no matter what the resistance is, there's something interesting that keeps getting achieved.
I agree with you. It's a spiritual war as well. A lot of people say that. A lot of people do. You can feel it. You can feel the stuff. And boy, it's far from over. That's for sure.
Yep.
But I agree with you. I wish we had a UFO sound effect. At least then we could like lighten it up a little with the UFO
Damn.
Sound. Do you have any
yes.
sound effects over there?
I can build a soundboard.
Yeah.
I can do.
We gotta we'll take it up a notch with some sound effects, and I can just like, you know, call for a sound effect at some point.
That's it.
Do you want to talk about, I'm almost like tempted to just have you tell us what you think's going on.
With what?
With the intergalactic planetary.
Intergalactic planetary planet.
You got it. Thank God you got it.
I listen to a lot of different stuff, especially late at night. Once the sun goes down, I love listening to people like Clyde Lewis, and I listen to the Higher Side Chats podcast. It's just a lot of paranormal, parapolitical type of stuff. Just because it's cozy to me. I don't necessarily believe one way or another that there is an ancient reptilian race that is inhabiting underground bunkers and facilities deep under the sea and all that stuff. But I don't completely discount it either. You know, it's stuff like that that I have a lot of fun with. And I believe that there are things that are beyond our comprehension that are happening, and spirituality plays a role in it. And if anybody believes that we're the only things, the only conscious the only people that the only objects, carbon-based life forms in this universe that can create conscious thought, intelligent thought, that's far beyond anything I can accept. And I think that whereas our own human spirituality is going to lead us to a new understanding of our role in the galaxy, to be honest, and this whole dependence on worldly forces and being able to be kept in place by fear is shedding away. We're shedding that exoskeleton now, because if you think about how real creative we are, the artists that we are, the creators that we are, the philosophers that we have shown that we can be, the builders that we are, whatever it is, I mean, athletics to performing arts, we are really a remarkable species. And if you think that our only purpose was to be ghettoized in a way and provided for by governments, where only the top echelon of society is able to live and really experience what what life should be and the beauty of experiencing the world around us and understanding and looking toward the stars and contemplating our part and our role in the universe. That is just not what we are. To be ghettoized in this way and to be politicized and divided up in this way, I really do believe that we're going to be shedding that soon. It might be a hard landing. It might be a soft landing. But either way, we're not meant for this. We're literally treated like cattle.
Mm.
Cattle by the people who pretend to care for us the most. And whether or not you look to the stars and you wonder who's out there looking back at us, or even if you're just looking within yourself and connecting to whatever you believe to be that creative force of the universe, God, Gaia, whatever the hell it is, there's something else that we're knocking on the door. And I think that the next step is walking through that and joining the galactic community a little bit in a more productive way. Freeing way.
Wow, I'm glad I asked. That was interesting. That was interesting. A lot more interesting than Papadopoulos talking to Joseph Mifsud, that's for sure.
Yeah, who the hell wants? I mean, that's we take care of that just because if you understand the human animal and how we all work and how we interact with each other, we make our. I don't know. I mean, this is all of our own scheming. It's all of our own. We devise all of this stuff and we live within our own nonsense. You know, who is the dreamer? You know, we are the dreamers who live within inside the dream. And I just don't get how anybody can think that this is all there is.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that might sound, I might have just lost a lot of people, but those are just like the late night thoughts I have. And that's it. That's all.
The late night musings of Frankie Val.
That's it.
That's okay. That's
Judge
good.
Not.
That's all right. You know, why not? Why not? It's a free thinking show. I mean, we're not following anything that we wanted to talk about right now anyway. So let's just, whatever. It's all good. Yeah. It's Friday. And we could start getting into Podesta if we wanted to go down that route too. But let's see. How do we?
Yeah, you want to talk about reptilians?
It's not my avenue. I don't know enough about it to be able to like accurately speak to anything there.
I don't either. I honestly don't either. I just know that those theories exist. But when I see, last night on my show, I was talking with Rob about, you know, separating the idea that human beings, especially in governments and these unelected bureaucrats, doing whatever they can to work together to preserve the life they've always had and to expand that life and to ensure that going forward, they're able to pick their successors and keep the current system in place. I said, that right there is something that you see translated into even just our personal lives. I mean, it doesn't matter if you are in a government office building, or if you are a camp counselor, you know that if you give a human being just a little bit of power, very few of us are able to use that power for something that's mutually beneficial and then kindly give it back up at the end of the day. Now, separating that very, very logical, easy to see human tendency that we have from actual evil, from people and from ideas that has malintent, when we're talking about human trafficking, when we're talking about just using human beings as political leverage and whatnot, that's something that goes into a little bit more of a spiritual rot. And that's why I believe that there are definitely some type of there is a conversation about good and evil out there, as well as just a conversation of, okay, well, that's just a very human thing to do, or we can debate this policy or that policy, and who was whispering rumors here, who is trying to crash a market here, who is trying to frame somebody within the FBI over here. I think there's a difference between all that stuff and just evil, and I think that that's it.
I really wonder. This is something like an exercise that goes on inside my head all the time. I really, really wonder how many of the, like, you know, a lot of these people are just compromised, they're leveraged, they're blackmailed, they were brought into the dark side. But I always say, like, it can only go on for so long, like evil, dark, black, whatever you want to call it. It can only exist for so long before that there needs to be a natural universal balance in that energy. It just doesn't work that way. It doesn't just stay evil forever. It just doesn't.
Yeah, well, why do you think so many of the people that, I mean, that certain circles will analyze and say, okay, those are evil people right there. This person is always seems to be on scene when there's a major catastrophe, when there's a disappearance of people. Whenever you look at those people, they're usually also some of the most philanthropic people on the planet. So I do believe, and people have made this point before, that watch some of the more dubious characters in the world, the George Soros types. They're always there when something goes wrong, but they also balance out that karma by giving a lot of money away too. So I believe that they believe in karmic balance as well. The whole point is, but speaking to what you said, when is that not going to be enough?
Well, it's not enough when the intent of giving is not correct. That doesn't wipe the karmic scale. Just because a person decides to give somebody $1 billion to clean up a mess that they themselves created, but when they give the $1 billion, they're not giving it in a genuine manner. I don't think that wipes the karmic scale clean for that person. I think it makes it worse, to be honest. It's like a cover-up for themselves. You know, they can't admit it internally that they've done something wrong. So they try to cover it up with the only thing that makes them do anything in this world, which is money. And it's not that the money is evil. It's that the lust for it from the person, the lengths they're willing to go for power and money, that's what's evil. Not the power, not the money. Because you can have a just leader who has a lot of power and does not abuse said power. Mm-hmm. It's really what's inside of you. So you look, I wonder, I really wonder, I used to do this all the time. put yourself in someone else's shoes and try and think about the argument the way they do. So like, let's try to put ourselves in like a Peter Strzok or a Lisa Page's shoes for a second. What are they thinking? Do they really believe that they're saving the country by doing this? Or do they really believe that they're saving this power structure and this plan that was put in place, God knows how many centuries ago, to do whatever they're trying to accomplish doing? Do they believe they're saving that? And like we believe we're correct here. And a lot of people on the left believe they're correct. And we both believe it just as fervently and strongly. So we know, you know, we've got facts to support us. They really don't. But what do you think? Do you think that they believe they're doing the right thing inside, or do they know they're doing the wrong thing?
They have to know they're doing the wrong. I think that some people believe that no matter, if you're under the guise that what you are a part of is what is necessary, then you're willing to, you know, to be that little, that Cobra character, that Sylvester Stallone, who is able to say, okay, you know what, this is the law, but I'm going to have to bend the law to make sure that I get to really do what's right. Sometimes the law doesn't provide for a person to go out above and beyond to fight what they believe is evil, which is the reason why, as more and more as this is uncovered about the inner dealings and the inner dialogue between people like Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, that the more that is uncovered and made public, you know, the rolling of the eyes that you get from people who support the party that they were obviously working for, and dedicated to, you get the rolling of the eyes when there's not a lot of information out there. And then the more information that comes out that damns them and their intentions, you get more people just rationalizing away that, well, hey, listen, you know, they're talking about an insurance policy against a man who is literally Hitler. If you had a chance to stop literally Hitler before he can rise to power, would you not bend a few laws to save humanity? If you believe that the path you're on is righteous, then all of this stuff is okay, at least in the meantime. It's almost like Star Wars granting the Emperor emergency war powers. You think they're going to give it back, though? Once you create that precedent, that's all you need, which is why, I mean, even when we were talking about the Iran deal and how it was passed with Bob Corker and Ben Cardin, you can say what you want about the deal, whether or not it was good or not. The problem is you created a precedent, and that's what we have been seeing going on within the agencies, too. And, as far as their dedication to their mission, you can tell that they feel completely righteous in that fact.
I want to go through, I before we started doing the show, I put together like a list of names of some of the cast of character that are involved in this whole thing. Some of the characters that are involved. And I'm just going to read it off quick. If you come up with anyone I missed, throw them in. Yep. But just listen to how in-depth this is and how deep it goes, just on a very 30,000-foot level. We have Manafort, Gates, Papadopoulos, Page, Sater, Cohen. I'm putting Schneiderman in there. Fusion GPS, Glenn Simpson, Nellie Orr, Bruce Orr, Hillary Clinton, Mark Elias, John Brennan, Clapper, Strzok, Comey, Halfer, Mifsud, Downer, Steele. I have another page. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, I definitely want to add a name to that, a name that I think should be brought up a lot more than it is, and that is Evelyn Farkas.
Yeah, tell me a little bit. Tell me, I know you've done some stuff there. Tell me about that.
All you have to do is go on YouTube and just listen to all of the, especially when you're talking about unmasking. So you go Susan Rice, Samantha Power, and then, of course, Evelyn Farkas. I mean, she has been so openly, she's been so open just in the way that she's been interviewed on television.
You know what? You're right. I'm remembering. She's the one who said, and that's why you're seeing the leaks, right?
That's why you're seeing the leaks. We saw this and we knew that we needed to get this out as much as we can, all this information out as much as we can before the new administration came in, and it would potentially disappear. Pretty much all the unmasking of the people who were having communications with foreign agents that were under surveillance. So they were creating this need to have unmasked American citizens who had no warrants and no surveillance orders on them, just to say that they were in the same room as Russians. Or,
yeah.
You know, and Evelyn Farkas, she's very, very important because she has been so out in the open. And you can see that she, with some of the questions being asked to her, she can tell in some of these interviews that she actually is probably opening herself up to big trouble. Her eyes get as wide as saucers and her body language is really crazy.
I really think at this point, to be quite honest with you, some of these people are running around flailing to try and protect themselves. Like, I'm of the firm belief that Jim Comey's book tour was a visibility tour for him. Mm-hmm. Because think about it like this. You know, there's a lot of people that go back and forth about him, good guy, bad guy, whatever. He several times has volunteered, like he basically went up and talked to about Hillary Clinton in that press conference, named a list of her crimes, bullet pointed for everybody, then said if it was anybody else, they'd be arrested, and walked away. He did the same thing to Loretta Lynch, unprovoked, during, you know, under oath about the matter. He's basically thrown, I think he's just a weak guy, but I think he's thrown a lot of stuff out there. And yeah, he seems to have some kind of like sociopathic disorder or something in terms of his greatness. And, you know, he's 7 foot tall. It's not like if he were to have to go into witness protection, somebody was going to be able to hide the man.
All of these people, just exactly to your point, all of these people know how tangled this web that they're involved in is. They understand that this very thin veil of blackmail that keeps everybody in place is rotting away, that the rats are going to be jumping ship one at a time. They're exposing each other wittingly or unwittingly, and all they have left, whether it be Hillary Clinton, who is still on a book tour for this book that nobody cares about, all over the world, all these people have left is visibility and trying to make sure that they have enough capital built up in the court of public opinion. Because that is the only trial that they can possibly win. Because the only real evidence that is out there that is verifiable works against them. Think about Hillary Clinton and James Comey. Just like you said, he stood up in front of those cameras on July 5th, 2016 for 13 minutes and listed verifiable crimes.
Yeah.
Verifiable crimes. Yeah, he tried to go and redefine how intent played a role in things that have no bearing on the matter. You know, just almost pretty much like, and with the help of Peter Strzok, now that we know about this all these years later, just pretty much saying that the concept of gross negligence is not even a thing to be considered here. But still, he got in front of the American people and said the work has been done. These are all of the crimes that we found. Okay, so the work has been to say that Hillary Clinton committed no crimes. Oh, no. What happened was James Comey said, we're not going to enforce the law. The first 13 minutes was saying, here's the laundry list of crimes that were committed. The work has been done. The problem is that there is a structure in place that is preventing justice from being delivered.
And interestingly enough, we learned just the other day with the new drops. I don't know if people know this, but the FBI dropped a whole bunch, like 30,000 documents of, I think 30,000 was a Freudian slip, but they dropped thousands and thousands and thousands of emails from Hillary Clinton and documents in regards to her investigation on Sunday morning at like 10 in the morning that nobody really has talked about at all, that I've been digging through. And one of my friends on Twitter found that that investigation was ongoing in July after they said that they had stopped it. They continued investigating. So something was going on there behind, you know, all of this stuff is coming out. The thing is, and I keep talking about this, they have leverage on each other. And I think what my job is and what our job is in talking about this stuff is to remove their leverage in the court of public opinion. Because the more that we show people what's going on, the more that we show factual information, talk about this stuff, the more people are armed with this stuff to talk to their friends about, which then removes their leverage in the court of public opinion. And once that's gone, because we don't try cases in the court of public opinion, we try cases in a courtroom. So everybody who wants the indictments and wants everybody to be arrested, I want a solid case. I don't want a show trial, you know? It's just so important. I can't rush this. As much as we all wanted to. This is 50 years of swamp being drained in 18 months.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
It's just, and they have no loyalty to anybody, not even themselves. They will flip on themselves if they think that they can get ahead by doing it. And that's the problem. When you build a network based around fear, because that's all it is, fear that they will release a bit of information about you, fear that they will take away your money, fear that they will take away your power, it falls apart. There's nothing strong holding that, because as soon as somebody's leverage is gone, then they are then useless.
Mm-hmm. My mother is, she's bringing over a friend of hers, this old school Italian New York. I think you're going to like, if you watch tonight's show, you're going to like him, Tony.
Oh, and no, that's great.
Yeah. She's bringing by a guest tonight. And she told me, you know, I told Tony that you're a Trump supporter, and he thinks that FDR is the greatest president of all time. And he doesn't like Trump. I said, well, you know what, Mom? I don't identify myself as a Trump supporter, Mom. It's just that I support Trump when things are going, you know, when we're starting to move in the right direction again, starting to go back to anything that reflects Americanism and the Constitution and checks and balances and even semi-normal constitutional order. But in the middle of me trying to tell her that it's a little bit more nuanced than that, and there's a point to this. She says, oh, okay. And I'm like, no, stop. That's very frustrating right there, where it's just, you try to tell people that 50 years of swamp draining, or 50 years of swamp building, I guess, and flooding being drained within 15 to 16, 17 months or whatever the hell it is. This is more of the point that I always try to drive to people, that this president, at the very most, will be gone by 2024. And the people who have created the problem, the problems that we deal with every day, are in office for decades.
Yeah.
Decades. This is not about rooting for Donald Trump to fix the country, even in 8 years, a problem that was created over the course of generations. This is about getting back to American roots. I mean, this is nothing. If you think about the Leaning Tower of Pisa, if we are the Leaning Tower of Pisa and we're about to topple over, I looked at Donald Trump when I voted for him. I was very cautiously optimistic. I said, what the hell? I voted for a hand grenade. That's what I voted for. I wanted somebody to completely disrupt the gears in Congress. And I voted for the Supreme Court and hoped that we can just tip the tower 1 inch back to the center. That's all I wanted to do it again. Just to create the momentum to go the other direction, because ultimately, especially beyond 2024, it's all up to the individuals. This is not about one person.
I agree with you. I was actually thinking about when you were telling me about your mom. I agree with you 100%. It's so important. The funny thing is, like, I listened to the clips with your mom, who seems like just a beautiful, she's beautiful, first of all, and she's so sweet. I mean, she just seems like the best, you know, most genuine person, but she's not at the same time. No offense to your mom. Because she's talking about, like you said, Trump and his wife don't get along. And you said he just denuclearized the Korean Peninsula, and you're worried about whether or not they're holding hands when they go out.
But that's, like I said, that's not her talking. That's Whoopi talking.
I know. It's The View. And that's the thing. Like, and then, you know, people just can't be bothered with understanding how important this really is. They can't be bothered with it. They kind of just, like, I felt like this the whole time that I was doing all the work I did for Ron Paul. I felt like this too. People thought that I was absolutely crazy. Why do you give a crap? Why do you care so much, Tracy? Well, I care so much because we're going down a very slippery slope and we're close to crashing into the tree at the bottom. And, you know, I never thought that I would jump behind a president like Trump, but I'm so glad that I recognized very early on the same thing I think you did in a little bit of a lesser way. I saw exactly what he was going to do. And I knew that he was going to win. I just knew it. The campaign was a topsy-turvy ride of, you know, breaking norms that had not been broken in decades about the media. And it was like, it was a breath of fresh air. And he's a breath of fresh air. Even his rally last night, did you happen to catch any of it?
I haven't watched it yet, but I know what happened.
So refreshing. It's just, I don't care how crass he is. He cursed at an audience once. I was like, yes, thank God, a normal person People don't understand. Like, this is we need to keep carrying the torch forward, though. It's not like you said. It's not what happens when Trump's not in office anymore. We just go back to normal. We have to keep this office accountable forever.
Yeah. Trump's out of office in let's say he wins re-election, which I don't know how. I think as of right now, I don't know how it doesn't happen, to be honest. But let's go to 2025. Trump is out of office, so guaranteed he's gone. What happens then? Okay, well, that's it. America's fixed now. We can just coast and coast into the future. It's just, that's why I try to always keep people sober. This is not about, everybody talks about cult of personality. That is a real thing. It doesn't matter if you're talking about a president or if you're talking about any number of things that go on around the internet. Cult of personality is a very, very real trap. And it's collectivizing. And I think the problem that we have right now is collectivization. We got to find the individual and we got to find what made actually America great. And that was being able to empower the individual and getting government, for the most part, out of their way, or at least localizing government in a way where they can more effectively influence
what actually happens.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way that, you know, I get a lot of people, when I talk about foreign affairs and stuff like that, Iran, Syria, whatnot, talk about what might be good, what might be bad about it. And I get, and I like it too, because it makes me go research, and I like the conspiracy end of it. But I get a lot of people who tell or who interject about world globalism, Zionism, big plots to get the world collectivized in some way that we don't even see, you know, dual citizenship and whatnot. And I'm telling myself, it's like, okay, noted. But what does Tracy, as an individual, what are we really going to do about any of the military adventurism that is going on around the world right now? Nothing. We as individuals have nothing to do with that right now, because we are such a top-down instead of bottom-up society. We have no influence because we're not thinking about what's going on in our state level. We don't care about our state legislatures. We don't care about how we are, midterm elections and who we're sending to the Senate and how they're representing us and holding them accountable. None of that is going on. The attrition rate in Congress is not that, like I said before. Decades. People spend decades in Congress. Does that mean that they are actually serving the people well for decades?
Nope.
Absolutely not. And if you don't have those people going out there who actually can hit the stop button or the pause button on the way that we are deploying our military, or the way that we're allowing our economy to be, milked by the rest of the world and the UN and all this stuff, then there's absolutely no reason to believe that a couple of people out there think they're going to stop some kind of a globalized military industrial complex just because we are woke on some kind of a blogger level. I mean, we're not going to do any of that stuff. We've got to be able to get down to grassroots again, because no matter how much bitching we do, it's not going to stop anything unless we reconnect and actually get down local again.
Look what's going on in California right now. Have you seen what they're doing in terms of the sanctuary cities? Have you out there? I'm sorry?
The resistance to it?
Yes.
But there is, you're talking about the surprising amount of resistance Californians have had to sanctuary cities, right?
Yeah, they're right now, they've got this big campaign ongoing into like 10 or 12 or 15 different cities. They've got massive coalitions of people locally going to local committees, local board, kind of like chair people meetings. They're standing there in front of, their local representatives, and they are loud and they are passionate and they're not letting it go. And that is where these people, I used to go to these things. These people don't give a crap what their constituents say. They sit there, they read their, they don't pay attention. They talk to one another while their constituents are standing in front of them, telling them their grievances. Granted, some of it's, oh, this person's, growing flowers on my side of the fence and all that noise. You get that, of course.
Yeah.
But there are people who bring legitimate grievances to their their representatives that they have, you know, that are there for us, and they're thrown out or they're laughed at or they're, you know, silenced or they don't get to fill out their time. And this is local and nobody sees it and nobody stops it. And that's where change happens locally every time.
Absolutely. And until that gets reiterated, it's going to be a pretty interesting decline. And there are other things that we have to just realize here. We're still $21 trillion in debt. We have hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of unfunded liabilities. Spending has not been cut yet, even though taxes have been cut. I don't know how the currency really corrects itself and stabilizes, and we get to go back to really backing it with something that is a little bit more tangible, something other than faith. And you look at all this stuff, is we're going to still have to go through some hard times, but we just got to get tough about it. For so long, because we've allowed other people to coddle us like their nannies, I think that they, for the sake of retaining voting blocks and keeping people where they are and retaining, business as usual and all that, you have people who have been shielding us from feeling pain of just the normalcies in business fluctuation and economic corrections and the markets and whatnot, and trying to make sure that little, you know, dips and dives, we don't feel the effect of that anymore. And we do that through things like quantitative easing, and we just flood the market full of monopoly money and stuff like that. We have been avoiding a lot of pain. And I think that that's going to be part of the reckoning here. We're going to have to really just get tough with it. I've also seen, especially out there in California, I love when people show up to those town hall meetings and whatnot and make their voices heard. I love how they talk about immigration in very big ways. I mean, the greatest thing about that is when actual immigrants, people who came, who saw the American dream in front of them, and they said, I want in on that. I want out of this banana republic way of life. And they come there and they actually spit in the face of the narrative, spit in the face of the stereotypes that every person from below the Rio Grande is going to be some sort of a far left kook who wants to be taken care of by a government, even though that way of thinking is what has been destroying Central and South America for years. You know, so it's really interesting that I see a lot of more people, even though a lot of it is just ceremonial, putting together petitions to actually break apart California and into separate states. That would be interesting. Can you imagine if Northern California actually had a voice again?
Yeah, it's crazy what's going on over there, and it's really hopeful. It makes me feel really hopeful because it's so important. It really is. Like, and it gets national attention now, and it inspires other people. Listen, if California didn't have the help of the federal government, it would be Venezuela. It already looks that way. I've seen videos. I saw a bike ride someone did. I don't remember exactly what area they drove through. Tent cities everywhere. It's bad. It is bad. And there are some really rich, very beautiful areas in California. Don't get me wrong, but there are some places in California where it's horrible. And the, you know, like you said, the people who came here, who fought to come here, who don't want to fly their flag outside their house because they're here in America and they've assimilated, they're speaking out too, which, like you said, makes a big difference because it doesn't allow the narrative to continue to be pushed. And this was actually, I'm looking at the clock. We're winding down now. What a great episode this was.
Oh yeah. We went all over the place.
We did. We jumped all over the place. We did not follow our outline at all. I'm about to junk outlines altogether. And
actually, you know, you think about it. When we started off with something that is really breaking right now, the Wall Street Journal thing, the FBI hit a mole in the Trump campaign. We did that really well, and that just opened the door to a lot of other things that were, to be honest, relevant. I think just as relevant as anything that we could have hoped for. So I don't think that the, you know, junking of formats is a bad thing. I think just that whenever the change happens, just go with it.
I think I'm going to call this episode Planetary Intergalactic.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Dark to Light with Frank and Beans. We'll be back next week at 5 p.m. Eastern on radioinfluence.com. Tune in, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, and all the other amazing platforms out there for podcasts. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Can't wait. Take care, guys.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
One of the awesome, awesome things I got to do while recording with Nancy Grace was to share the stage with the survivors of the Golden State Killer. And as you know, he was just arrested based on DNA that was submitted to one of those ancestry type companies. There were two of his actual rape victims on the stage. One woman was the sister of one of his victims that was murdered. And the other woman was the daughter of one of the women that was murdered. I watched Debbie when the show first started, and they were just going down the line and talking to each of these victims. And I literally could see Debbie over there praying silently and patting on her chest. And you could tell she was hyperventilating. And this happened, you know, nearly 40 years ago, but it was just amazing how much, you know, she was still touched by it, as well as all the other victims. And I'll be honest, it doesn't happen too often, but it brought a tear to my eye.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.